Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, hard disk drives, Thailand's recovering from the flood, people. Secret specs from Intel's next chip, Ivy Bridge, SSD survival. Should you move the page file, Mobile World Congress, the quad-core system on a chip you've never heard of, and Intel's first cell phone. Some SSDs suck more battery power, get your PC's heat out of the house, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 159, recorded March 1st, 2012. Bury the PCs. This episode of Twitch is brought to you by Ford, featuring the EcoBoost engine with turbocharger and direct injection. Look for EcoBoost on the 2012 Explorer and Edge, the 2013 Escape, and at Ford.com/technology. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Gorton. This is the show on Twit where we talk about, guess what, computer hardware, and occasionally a little bit about what's going on in the tablet world, because it seems like all the operating systems want to live on the tablets too. Ryan Trout, our usual partner on the show, or usual as most people would call it, is flying from Dallas back to his hometown. So we got a special guest on today, the PC Pro Hardware maven, Alan Malventano. Alan, how you doing tonight, man?
Hey, what's up, Patrick?
I'm good. We have a lot of news. Alan, you and I were talking about this before the show about how kind of unhinged the news stories were this week, partially because of Mobile World Congress 2012. But some people in the chat room really wanted me to ask you, before anything else, how do you feel about the new Coca-Cola Freestyle machines?
I have not benchmarked said device yet, but I will soon. I don't know.
Ryan is obsessed. Trout is obsessed with Coca-Cola Freestyle machines.
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm a party to more conversations about that than you might even know.
Imagine. Be afraid, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
All right. Getting back to the hardware news. We haven't had a new world's fastest graphics card in a few days, but we do have a completely unhinged overclocking effort for HD 7970s. It's pretty crazy. Jeremy Hellstrom summarizes it. It would be quite the feat to find a case to contain the system below with four HD 7970s powered by two 1200 watt power supply units, plus assorted components, not to mention the heat this system will produce. Not even the Asus Mars 2 and SLI can keep company with this monstrosity, and the scaling from a pair of HD 7970s is rather impressive. Usually, in the past, you know, a third and fourth card didn't do much for scaling. It turns out, at this point, with the four HD 7970s, even a Core i7-3960X running at 4.8 gigahertz cannot feed these GPUs. So the system could actually be more impressive. This is that shot you saw there. That's $2,200 worth of GPUs. And Overclock3D.net has the story. They're calling it the Asus 7970 Quad Fire. And yes, they say they're basically using a combination of a BIOS update for the Asus Rampage 4 Extreme with the Asus BIOS on the cards themselves. And they're running the cards at 1,225 megahertz. The benchmark numbers are stupid. So if you're into overclocking and you think you might want it, that, you know, if you've got a lot of monitors to power, or, you know, a 4K monitor you've been looking to feed with the latest in gaming action, and you have $2,200, which you probably do if you have a 4K monitor, this is your system.
Yep. And when you're not using that, you can use the power supplies for arc welding.
Exactly. That's actually kind of a frightening thought. Did you try to order a Raspberry Pi, Alan?
I did not. And even if I did, I probably wouldn't have made it, because those things sold out in like 10 seconds, right?
Yeah. I spent 2 hours hitting refresh on two websites trying to purchase one when they went on sale, and failed epically. So the pre-orders all sold out. If you're not familiar with it, we've been talking about it a little bit the last couple of weeks. Raspberry Pi, it's going to be a $25 or $35 Linux PC about the size of a pack of cards with an HDMI port. The $35 version has USB and more memory. The $25 version doesn't have USB, or excuse me, doesn't have Ethernet. $35 version has Ethernet. The $25 version doesn't. And they should be able to run not only Linux, but actually play 1080p video. So you could have build yourself like a little DIY streaming box, which I'm pretty excited about. They like RS Components and Farnell were the sites hosting the original purchases. They just got crushed. I don't think anybody realized how big this was going to go when the sale went off. Thankfully, now both of those are basically foreign firms that sell outside of the U.S. and they picked up Element 14 is now handling the sales in the United States. So if you want to pre-order a board, you can go up to the Element 14 website, the Element 14 store, search for Raspberry Pi, and you'll not only find the Raspberry Pi pre-order form. So you can basically ask them to call you when they have one to sell you. You can also get a lot of Ben Heck videos talking about the new board. So
I can't wait to tinker with one of those. I can get my hands on it. That is just dirt cheap. And
yeah,
just think of how many quick, really small Linux distros are just going to be focused around like a media center front end for that thing. I mean, 1080p output, $30 device. You just stick it in your entertainment center or like double-sided tape it to the back of your television and forget about it.
It's going to be a field day for Plex and XBMC.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I hope Xbox Media Center gets a quick port just dedicated, like, you know, just tuned straight for that hardware, just with all the settings just ready to go, and that'd be perfect.
That would be
then
nice.
You wouldn't have, you know, so many people jailbreaking, hacking, or otherwise modifying some other device connected to their entertainment center to make it work, like I'm doing with an Apple TV, actually.
All right, which software are you running?
Just Xbox Media Center. On an okay. Apple TV. That's just, I used to use a little home theater PC setup, like one of those, Atom powered few hundred dollar things. And then I saw an Apple TV and I was like, I can jailbreak that and just do Xbox Media Center. Yeah. And I have been for months now. It's great.
It's a good thing. The hard disk drives are coming back. Can we expect hard disk drive prices to fall in the immediate future or the foreseeable future or before I die?
I don't know. Well, yes. Yes, hopefully that will be the case. I don't know. They're claiming 80% capacity will be restored by first quarter.
Wow.
Meaning the quarter we're in right now. So hopefully this is already in the works. And guess, you know, first quarter is that we're towards the end of the first quarter, actually. The issue, though, is even if their capacity gets restored, there's still sort of a backlog of people wanting to buy larger hard drives, I would imagine, that have been holding off. So right. I wouldn't expect everything to just drop immediately, especially when you think about enterprise sector being a pretty large consumer of the larger drives, which have more platters, et cetera, et cetera. The platters are the major part that's in short supply, since it was these plants that were making the platters primarily that were the ones affected by the flooding.
It's interesting. This is a DigiTimes article, and one of the things they talk about is how, you know, Hitachi, Global Storage, and Seagate actually were impacted. Were they impacted somewhat less or considerably less than Western Digital?
I don't know. I don't know the exact layout of the plants, but I know that everybody had plants in the flooding region and output. It just depended on what their percentage was.
Got it.
So yeah, Western Digital was hit pretty hard, but I think really all of them were hit. If you think about Western Digital is one of the bigger suppliers, right? So
right.
They were hit harder regardless. And then the other guys, they're smaller suppliers. Any kind of a hit is a bad hit on them because they're running closer to the margin. You know, their inventories are considerably less if they're not supplying as much volume. So I think everybody in the end just got it handed to them, by this flooding. And then they are coming back. We've seen hard drive prices coming down even over the past few months. Just not as far as we'd like, obviously, not to the degree that we've seen where we saw it nosediving before the flooding happened.
Yeah. At least getting closer. So what's going on with Intel and Micron? Because they've been partnered on flash memory, which of course is probably getting fed into portable devices and SSDs. And they just did a swap for a couple plants?
Sort of a swap, more like a handoff. IMFT is a joint venture between Intel and Micron. So Intel and Micron a few years back said, hey, let's do this flash memory thing together. You guys do a lot of memory stuff. We're getting into solid state flash memory stuff. We think we can innovate a little better. You know, Intel, that was probably Intel's argument because they're the bleeding edge of process nodes and die shrinks and everything else. So they did a joint venture. Their primary plant is in Lehi, Utah. I actually toured that a couple of years back when they launched 25 nanometer flash. That was cool. Ran around in a bunny suit and did all, you know, saw all kinds of really cool stuff going on. But they have several other plants. At least a couple of them. There's one in Singapore. There's one in Virginia. I want to say there's another one on top of that, but I can't recall. However, they basically renegotiated their deal, or the deal was about to expire, whatever their agreement was. So they just said, okay, what are we going to do moving forward? And right. Micron is going to assume 100% of the Singapore and the Virginia plants. Intel and Micron are going to stay 50-50 on the Lehi plant. Now, the Lehi plant is like the main spearhead, tip of the spear plant. It's the one where whenever they come up with a new anything, that's the plant that makes it first. Then just, you know, once they've perfected it there, then they, you know, send out the plans or whatnot and divvy out gear to the other plants, and then they follow along there. So really what this sort of does is it's not, you know, it's really good or bad news. It's sort of just, it just makes sense, something to do. Micron's just going to handle more of the work of cranking out the flash memory, and Intel can focus more on innovating because they're going to keep their stake in the plant that actually does, you know, pushes out the newer tech. So it really just makes sense. I can see why Intel wouldn't really want to mess around with the other two plants. I didn't even realize that they had a 50-50 stake, you know, in the other plants anyway.
Right.
So it sort of just made sense. And that's good because, you know, we definitely want Intel to stay involved with the shrinks. And then that gives Intel enough output to, you know, Intel makes their own lines of solid state drives. So the Lehi plant more than likely puts out enough flash for their devices. So they're covered there. And then they can, you know, if they can buy some off of the Micron side of it, if they really need to, no big deal.
A good thing. So what about the, it was kind of interesting. One of the articles we saw and you and I talked before the show, so we could easily talk about this for 20 minutes or hours matter.
Yeah.
So it's essentially optical RAM or RAM running at the speed of light.
The really short version is it's basically a RAM technology that you can read the bits optically.
Wow.
That's the easiest way to put it, right? So I think it was a week or two ago, we had optical writing magnetic media and flipping. Did you and Ryan talk about that a couple of shows ago, I guess?
Yeah.
Where you had that, where the issue was that you could write it, but you couldn't necessarily read it at that small, like with the magnetic read head. Now we have almost the opposite. So they can electrically modify a bit that has an optical property that can be read back. So it's now you got all these, it's weird, these kind of breakthroughs we're finding where we're just, you know, the breakthroughs occur and we're just sort of expecting someone to put all these together into one magical, you know, storage device that's...
But wait, last week a college professor said that memory was dead as a storage medium and the SSDs would never recover by... Sorry.
don't get me started on that one. Yeah. Just pushing my buttons now, buddy. Yeah, that was an interesting paper that I just ripped a new one.
Yeah.
But you guys talked about that last week.
Yeah, it was funny. It was like, yes, you know, memory will fall behind by this year. And it's like assuming that there are no actual advantages or it leaps forward in technology and in memory density, which is a pretty brazen assertion to make. But it made for good headlines.
There's been a few back and forth on if Ivy Bridge is going to be delayed, not delayed, et cetera, right? And they just accidentally, I don't know if it's accidentally or I quote unquote accidentally, published right on the Intel site. They had a PDF up for a little while today listing here's all the Ivy Bridge processor, you know, configurations and thermal power envelopes and everything.
Yeah, it was funny, like the TDP, the thermal design power. It's actually, that's probably the most interesting thing is looking at them running from Core i5s running at 17 watts, Core i7s running at like four-thread, like 17-watt parts all the way up through, looks like the maximum is 77 watts for some Core i5 and Core i7s.
Their top desktop parts now are 90-plus, right? So you're talking like their high-end is now lower power. Like their highest end is lower power than, you know, what some of their even mid-grades are right now, which is definitely a testament to, you know, and this is Intel specs. They're always really conservative on what they say is a specification. So if the thing, you know, if the thing could possibly peak to 77 watts, they're going to say that, yes, it's 77. That's not going to be like their average, you know. So yeah, that's cool because you see lower power draw on their highest end part, 3.9 gigahertz part. Right. That's for the automatic overclocking or whatever you want to call it. think of the overclocking headroom you might have on something like that, right? If it's only 77 watts and if you put beefy cooling on it and, you know, these gates already have a supposedly much improved switching time compared to the current technology, wow.
Yeah.
Right? You might, you could easily break 4 gigahertz on some of those parts probably right out of the box and probably even with the stock cooler, right?
It's still not going to be enough to fill the Quadzilla for HD 7970, but it will be a step in the right direction.
That's true, yeah. And actually, it does have improved integrated, like the ones that are equipped with the integrated off-to-the-side graphics. It's like an HD 4000 series, which we don't know what that really means in, you know, in terms of graphics performance, but...
It's the equivalent of a $60 GPU instead of a $30 GPU?
Probably, but hey, that's actually not bad. I have the test bed I'm running is like a 2600K
right.
for the storage test bed, and I'm to the point where there's no video card in there. I don't even bother, and I'm running, you know, it's running Vista, Arrow, or not Vista, my goodness, Windows 7, Arrow. Right. All the bells and whistles on, and I didn't have to really think about turning stuff off or, you know, just driving a decent-sized screen and...
But you're not gaming.
The truth is,
if you're not gaming, you don't need a GPU.
Right, but it handles flash. It handles video. I mean, think of the percentage of general PC users that don't necessarily game. They're just using their computer to use the computer. They're surfing. They're looking at videos online. And well, even no, there's no way.
I own two PCs that run off the onboard graphics. The third one just got a new GPU upgrade, so I can
right. So so you have like your this is my gaming
for
one.
Work. But,
right, but everything else you're just using the integrated stuff, you know, and it comes in handy. The i5s and there's an i7 mobile model. It's only running at 2 gigahertz, but it overclocks, or the automatic overclock is 3.1. It's still a 17 watt TDP chip, and it's got the HD 4000 stuff on there. So I mean, it's good, you know. If it's any better, it's still only 17 watts. Right, you put right. something like that in, you know, an Asus, you know, Ultrabook, or you know, it'd be perfect. Right.
Problem is, we need the power consumption by the screen to drop down. It's still the screen in a notebook is still the number one consumer of power in a notebook, because especially now if you throw an SSD in it and some of the new low power parts, it's actually amazing to look at the delta between the power consumption on the storage and the CPU versus the power consumption on the flat panel. And then we need bigger batteries, and then we need ponies.
It's funny you mentioned that power draw thing. I'm actually looking into that. It's some of the stuff I'm looking at in the background is different SSDs designed for ultrabooks and their power consumption.
Oh, interesting. So there's an actual delta between sort of, there are lower power consumption SSDs that are going into the ultrabooks? Question mark.
They're all different based on what controller it is.
Oh, really?
And in particular, SandForce controllers are known to be sort of power hungry. Now, you never really notice this in a desktop, but you know, a typical SandForce SSD is almost 1 watt draw when it's active. It's like 800 milliwatts. Now, when you think about that in terms of an ultrabook that has really, you know, they don't have a lot of battery in there.
Yeah.
They last so long because they sip on the little bit that they do have. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing though to look at and see what your difference in performance is when you or how long you can have that performance is a better statement, right? Until your battery runs out and then you have zero performance.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah.
AMD has kind of, so if you look at PCPer.com, it's been really rough for AMD's processor crew, especially their PR crew. AMD updates the FX line as a story. Some thoughts on future moves for AMD. One of the things that Josh Walworth points out in the article is that AMD basically sacked most of the PR team and information is not particularly flowing in a big way. But he writes, what we do know, AMD has released two new processors into the market, the FX4170 and the FX6200. The 4170 is a dual module, four-core, 125-watt part that is clocked at an amazing 4.2 gigahertz stock speed and a turbo that goes to 4.3. This is the fastest consumer-grade processor in terms of clock speed, but it obviously is not the fastest processor on Earth. It's the sort of clock speed versus work done equation. The original FX4100 is a 91-watt part at 3.6 gigahertz, 3.8 turbo, 4 megs of L2 cache, and 8 megs of L3. The FX6200 is perhaps the more interesting of the two. It has a base clock of 3.8 gigahertz, a max turbo speed of 4.1 gigahertz, compared to the FX6100, which was running at 3.3 and 3.9 in turbo mode. 125-watt TDP again, and the 6200 is a three-module, six-core part with 6 megabytes of L2 cache and a whopping 8 megabytes of L3. And the FX8120 is going to get a price cut to put it more in line with the competition. Josh continues, and we do not know the prices, he says, but we do not know the rollout schedule, and we have no idea how much the FX8100 is going to be chopped. Right now, yeah. Though, it's looking at like somewhere around 260 to 289, 290 for the high-end version, the FX8150. So it's going to be interesting to see what goes on with AMD over the next few months.
Yep. The way things are looking, they may very well launch with no review sites publishing at the same time unless they like, yeah. That's sort of a thing when you see those things happen, and I mean, you know, just not a guarantee, obviously, but when you see those sorts of things coming, then you're just like, okay, maybe they're really so close on the margin on this thing,
right?
That, you know, on the threshold of this thing might just not work properly, and there might be issues that we don't want a PR disaster, so let's just launch it. Just here, it happened. They're for sale if you want to see.
That was one of the things Ryan also pointed out at his last meeting with AMD, was that basically they've kind of given up the war with Intel over performance on the desktop. They're basically, they've thrown in the towel might be a better sort of turn of phrase for that. And they're much more interested in, you know, obviously they're taking names and kicking ass on the GPU side of things, and the yep. CPU stuff is more under the radar, you know, integrated with large developers and people who want to go crazy. Doing self-builds can maybe do that on their own if they want to choose our brand. And also, while we're talking about AMD, Asus's DirectCU, which you might also think of as being their direct copper, giant pile of copper heat sinks. DirectCU 2 is now out on AMD alongside NVIDIA 6850, 6870, 6950, and 6970 boards. Basically a collection of reviews on that. And it's kind of funny. It's basically... DirectCU is a big pile of copper and up to 5 heat sinks to more efficiently pull the heat off the board.
Yep, it's basically heat pipes that go straight to the GPU.
Yeah, which is
like as close as they can get them. Yeah.
I likes me copper for conducting heat. So if you're curious about that, you can pick up the article on PC Purr. And then we should probably talk about mobile news. We're going to try to move fast through this. Mobile World Congress 2012 took place this week. It is the number one biggest, most important epic event in the mobile industry. When I say mobile, I mean cell phones and tablets. Also timed this week is Apple's release of the invitation for what everybody assumes is the iPad 3 event based on the little picture. So March 7th, iPad 3, we'll know for sure. But right now, the general information it's floating around is that it's going to be a fantastic super duper retina type screen. There may be a 7-inch tablet, says DigiTimes. Most people say no, because even with Steve Jobs gone, he hated 7-inch tablets so much no one expects Apple to move in that direction. More credible is the rumor that the iPad 2 will live on in the future as a low cost iPad to compete against the dozens of Android tablets that are selling in small volume. And then, where to start? So first thing is a quad-core mobile manufacturer.
Huawei.
Huawei. Excuse me?
Huawei.
Huawei. Yeah. Yeah.
So those guys are making a quad core ARM that's basically going to be a direct competitor to just the other, you know, the A9 part
right. That's
already out there. But the thing is that this one has a 64-bit memory controller, and it does some stuff faster. Like they have, you know, granted this is PR benchmark numbers to go off of, but you know, when they say, okay, GPU performance could be like twice as fast and 49% faster on purely CPU-based tests, and all of that while using 30% less power. Now, that's PR stuff, and, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But whenever somebody comes along and remakes something, it tends to be better. Right. when they start from scratch, because you get the guys that are all like, oh, we've been doing it this way for 3 years and it's all great and it is, everything's perfect. And then somebody else comes along and, you know, I mean, that was how the core architecture.
Right.
Yeah. That was how the core architecture saved Intel when they were really neck and neck with AMD. Right. And it's just other company off to the side that just reinvented the wheel. They're like, hey, we can make this thing go really, really fast and just slap some x86 instructions on it and it'll still, you know, fly. Same kind of thing. Right. These guys might be doing the same kind of thing when you re-architect something from the ground up, which obviously they did since they're not patent sharing
or
anything, right? So they had to just reinvent this. So this is sort of like the AMD. It's really backwards to say that, well, yes, we hope. Or otherwise, they won't be selling for very long once somebody else looks at it. But this is sort of like the AMD / underdog potential ARM.
Yes.
Which is really backwards.
It's kind of funny. It's funny because we've been talking about what's going on with, you know, NVIDIA at CES last year says that ARM is the future, so they're going to be concentrating on ARM architecture. Tegra 3, it's kind of funny. So the HTC is rolling with a Tegra 3 and the HTC 1. That was one of the big stories that came out of Mobile World Congress. Tegra definitely seems to have a future because they've got the plans laid out for a die shrink incorporating 4G into the system on a chip. They showed off 5 new games at Mobile World Congress 2012, some of them apparently very shiny. NVIDIA's having fun. They basically decided to integrate, to add touchscreen, what they call direct touch control, to their system on a chip, the Tegra. And the vendors seem to like that. It's basically one less part for them to source and design in there. So direct touch seems to be successful.
Yeah, that's hardware-based touch interface. It's, you know, it's and it's right. It's right there. It's in the chip, right? So it's definitely and you know, they needed something to use that fifth processor for.
And it's funny because Intel's been making all of this noise forever about getting into the mobile market because they see ARM taking off. They see the volume of ARM processors out there. They see Apple essentially is also using ARM because they use a their own design. They bought a company that modifies ARM chips to boost performance. And so Apple's got their own version of ARM. And then Mobile World Congress 12, Intel-branded Atom-powered smartphone to be sold by Orange. If you can't get any mobile vendor to buy your phone, maybe you should just... I mean, if you were a writer, this would be called vanity publishing.
I would be shocked to see how long this runs on the battery and how big the battery would have to be for it to last during the day. I mean, you're talking about an ARM and I think it's even like a dual core ARM.
Well,
no,
it's,
it can't
it's,
be.
Or Intel, Atom. But well, it's kind of funny. Niantic has the article. Ryan actually pointed out that he finds it interesting not only that Intel developed a processor that was actually getting attention in the mobile market, but this is a reference design that Intel built. And Orange was like, yeah, we'll sell that. At Niantic.com, there's a link there in the PC Per article, basically has the full specs on it. And also at mobile or at CES, because they announced that Lenovo and Motorola would bring Atom-based smartphones to market in 2012. And I want to say, yes, the Medfield, the Atom Medfield. So the Z2460 system on a chip, that's the first version of Medfield. More versions are expected, and it's out of the mobile and communications group. So while we like to torture the idea of Atom in a phone, this is actually not the Atom we all had in netbooks. This is a new design. And
despite a new design, it's sort of got a lot of things going against it just on specs. Like it has a gig of RAM.
Right.
A gig of RAM in a mobile device. Usually you're much lower than that because of that.
No. That's in the system on a chip. There's
right.
So you're saying that would be a negative?
Well, it's a gigabyte, right? Not
right.
Gigabit. I mean, I almost wanted to read that as gigabit. So it's like, that's a capital B.
Right.
And whether it's on the chip or not, that's a lot of RAM, right? It's a lot of flip-flops to power that DRAM is, you know, you have to refresh that. Refreshing it takes power. So maybe there's some advancements there. I sort of wish they would have combined this announcement with some kind of a technical, hey, look, here's this new chip and here's what makes it really good and here's how it does what it does and doesn't suck the battery dry in 2 minutes.
Right. Yeah, they don't talk about battery size. They're not offering information on battery life, but.
And they don't show the thickness of the phone in the pictures.
They do have the spec, though. I want to say it's like 9.9, 123 millimeters by 63 millimeters by 9.99 millimeters. So a hair's width under a centimeter thick. So
that's not bad.
That's manageable. And especially if you think about Intel not really being a cell phone manufacturer. I think it's a good first effort. I wait to hear reports of how Android 2.3 does running on the new new Intel processor. So one last story from Mobile World Congress. Samsung is going to compete with Tegra for quad-core CPUs. I haven't seen an update yet, but it was an Unwired review. 200 megahertz all the way up to 1.5 gigahertz while offering, quote, lower power consumption than current options. And then on graphics performance, the new Exynos comes paired. I hope that's how you say it. Exynos comes paired with the latest version of Samsung's own graphics chip, which has 4 pixel processors and 1 geometry engine with 128 kilobytes. Of L2 cache. The graphics support OpenGL ES 2.0 and can generate up to 57 megapolygons per second, million polygons per second.
Yeah,
I've never seen M polygons / S before. Samsung claims the new processor will offer 26% more performance compared to Exynos parts based on the 45 nanometer process, and that should be hopefully dual core versus dual core. So NVIDIA is not going to be the only system on a chip with quad cores. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. That's interesting. So ARM, Intel, NVIDIA, Samsung, who makes a whole lot of chips for a whole lot of people, all competing for the mobile market. So,
and then we move from all those CPUs into the possibility of taking your CPU and running it at a 15 times overclock, but only for a fraction of a second. And oh, by the way, that's the CPU that's in your pocket on your phone. Which is
Are we talking about computational sprinting? We don't usually Scientific American articles on Twitch.
No.
We're not usually that classy, but this was interesting.
It is. It's just basically they figured out. Actually, sorry, I misquoted 16 times. An extra 1 times. So basically you take a CPU and I don't know. I mean, 16 times. So we have CPUs that are mobile CPUs that are running at like a gigahertz right now. Right?
Right.
So I'm just trying to figure out like where they're going with this, because I don't know if process tech that can handle 16 gigahertz right now.
Okay. So this is what they're calling it, computational sprinting. And the quote from Scientific American is, a processor could run at, for example, 16 times its sustainable rate for about half a second, which is a long time if you're a computer, and then throttle back down so the processor can cool down until the next time a surge is needed. The researchers presented the findings of their computational sprinting feasibility studies yesterday at the 18th International Symposium on High Performance Computer Architecture in New Orleans. And the idea is that a lot of things that you interact with on your smartphone, like a video game or something, they need sort of, or for that matter, probably more accurately, like launching a video. There's like a little chunk of computational demand, quote, punctuated by long idle periods waiting for user input. So they could power down the core, launch the core, do the burst, this gigantic high-speed burst, and then shut the cores back down until it waits you know, several hundred milliseconds for you to respond to do something.
And that makes sense. Right. It's just and this is sort of on a very small and much more bursty scale than the Intel, the dynamic overclocking technology, where it can push a little harder for the first, 15, 20 seconds. And the assumption is that it takes a while for the die/ heatsink interface, all that metal, to heat up. Right. Well, so even though
I was going to say, that was part of what I thought was kind of particularly interesting is they were going to take the heat pulse from the sprinting, and they were going to use basically wrapping the chip in what they call a phase change material. So the material melts, and then they shut the processor down. The material cools off, and they use that to dissipate the heat. Kind of a really peculiar form. It's sort of a heat pipe, sort of a heat cover.
It's just a buffer, right? It's a phase change buffer. you can dump a lot more heat into something that changes phase than just, a hunk of metal, right? It'll heat up, the phase change thing will at least stay the same temperature for the majority of that transition. So that's, it's good. It's good. I just don't know how they're going to get this 16 times burst and the CPU not crash, So I guess that would be something that would have to evolve in the technology anyway.
Next up for the researchers is constructing a prototype focusing on the thermal and material issues, says Milo Martin, another study author and associate professor in the Department of Computer and Information Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania School of Engineering and Applied Science. So,
well, there you go.
They may be trying to figure that out themselves.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's a really cool idea, actually, if they can make it work. So hopefully they will.
Oh, yeah.
PC Perspectives leaderboard, pcper.com/leaderboard. That's a great place to find parts lists for various builds. This is a computer show, so that we get back into a little PC action here. Good article on that up at pcper.com. Also a link to the Tech Report, techreport.com, their March 2012 system guide. Both of these guides to building basically giant parts lists to build your PC. Tech Report says, to be perfectly honest, we haven't exactly drowned under a deluge of new hardware since we published our last guide. Overall, though, the PC hardware landscape has remained disappointingly static, down to the inflated mechanical storage prices caused by last year's Thai floods. So they augmented this guide with a, quote, fresh, one-of-a-kind build, the Schooner. Our other builds are the result of careful deliberations and debates between Tech Report's editors, but the Schooner is the unfiltered brainchild of TR editor-in-chief Scott Wasson. You can think of it as the build Scott might put together if he were shopping for new gear himself. So, ladies and gentlemen, there are lots of options for builds. I like how Tech Report, they have the Econobox, the Sweet Spot. No, it's the Econobox, Econobox Alternatives, the Sweet Spot Alternatives, the Editor's Choice, the Double Stuff Workstation, the Schooner, the Mobile Sidekicks, and more, ladies and gentlemen. So go forth and build a new PC if you're in the mood.
And then if you want to talk about SSD companies, OCZ is making a 1,000-watt power supply.
A fatality.
It's a fatality, 1,000 watts. I mean, they've introduced a line of power supplies recently. I saw a few of them at CES. It seemed like they were just starting to really try to take that seriously. And I did not see a 1,000-watt unit at CES when looking at their other ones. So that's kind of cool. Actually, it looks kind of cool with the... If only many cases had the ability to see the fan for the power supply, that would be a cool thing with a red fan on a black...
And the giant logo on the side.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cool looking power supply. It would be really cool for, like, say, my storage test bed, which happens to have the power supply just sitting out on a desk. But aside from that, the power supplies always tend to be hiding, usually. And then, what is it? Enermax had some, too?
Yeah, Enermax. They're claiming 87, the Revolution 87 plus 1,000 watt PSU, and Hard OCP did a roundup in their out of control PSU power supply unit benchmarking. Quote, proclaimed this is another step forward in PSU design for Enermax, retaining solid construction and power generation, as well as increasing efficiency and lowering noise. So they, and what's interesting is their Enermax is marketing it as 80 plus gold, even though it actually meets platinum standards. So.
That is a huge bundle of cables just hanging off of that thing.
And I have a system. Well, I have a system now with four hard drives in it that I'm trying to figure out how to put another two hard drives in it. Another system with six optical drives in it. And the extra cables can be really useful when you've got like five CD burners or CD ripping drives and two Blu-ray drives.
Patrick, do I even want to ask?
It's the Rip Monster 3000. It's the Rip Monster. You don't.
At one point, I had a SCSI, like a stack of SCSI Plexter drives. It was seven SCSI Plexter CD-ROM drives in a little external, SCSI enclosure. That was pretty cool.
You know, you worked in SCSI when the first thing you think of in termination is a dongle that doesn't work very well. It is finicky, and you don't think of being fired.
Yes, I'm very happy that they've made the transition to serial attached SCSI and just sort of stole the serial ATA stuff and used
SCSI
it.
SCSI configured automatically. Sure, it is.
Never.
Oh, goodness. Hey, let's take a moment to thank our friends at Ford sponsoring this episode of Twitch. Ford is featuring EcoBoost. EcoBoost is an engine technology from Ford that delivers the power of a larger engine in a smaller one. EcoBoost engine technologies help make the seven-passenger Ford Explorer the best-in-class in highway fuel economy. Basically, it's actually pretty cool, right? You got a vehicle that can carry seven people fairly comfortably, 28 highway miles per gallon in the 2.0 EcoBoost in front-wheel drive, classes large utilities. We like to get the details in there. And it's pretty simple. Ford sat down. Actually, it's pretty freaking complicated. Ford redesigned the conventional engine to meet fuel sufficiency standards. And they created EcoBoost energy technology by reducing the number of cylinders to produce efficiency, i.e. a smaller engine, less swept area inside the engine, and compensating for the loss of horsepower and torque through a combination of technologies, including two of my favorite engine technologies available today. Direct injection means pumping the fuel directly into the cylinder, and turbocharging. I love turbochargers. So
yes.
Yeah. Direct injection produces a cooler, denser charge, generates more power per drop of fuel. This is a good thing. While the two small engine-cooled turbochargers, two turbochargers, that's good. That means it pulls more heat out of the exhaust, which means it's used to power your vehicle. This is a good thing. They spool up more quickly than a single large turbo, which is awesome because I have dealt with turbo lag and I hate it. There is no turbo lag here. This is turbo kicking ass. Energy from the engine's exhaust, which would otherwise be wasted, rotates the turbine wheels. Yes! It's thermally efficient. Each turbine is coupled to a compressor that pressurizes incoming air, significantly reducing output per liter. In case you're not familiar with how a turbocharger works, you experience instantaneous low-end torque responsiveness with virtually no turbo lag. Look for the 2.0-liter EcoBoost engine on the 2012 Explorer and Edge. 2013 Escape, that's going to be out in spring 2012, will offer 1.6-liter and 2.0-liter EcoBoost options. And you can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. And everybody here at Twitch wants to thank Ford for their sponsorship of the show.
So gearheads listening to this podcast might cringe when they heard Patrick say 1.6 liter. You don't be surprised if you're getting a couple hundred horsepower out of a 1.6 liter with all that, right? If you put twin turbos and direct injection on, no matter how small the engine, it's going to go like stink.
It's cool. It's actually Twin turbochargers, they're not the future anymore. They're now. You speak twin turbos is a big race deal. You're talking about ridiculous amounts of money. It's amazing because, okay, turbocharger stuffs more air in the cylinder. More air equals more power because your engine's effectively a fancy air pump. The second turbocharger pulls a huge amount. It's amazing the reduction in exhaust gas temperatures you get with the second turbocharger. It is just really cool, and I'm going to talk about computer stuff. Twitch, twit.tv. That's our email address, twich@twit.tv. We love your questions, and we're going to keep the questions short this week because there was so much news. There's just a ridiculous amount of news. We're going to start out with a question for Alan. From anybody out there, especially me, who has a solid-state drive, what do you think, Alan, of moving the page file off of an SSD or eliminating it to minimize wear? I don't particularly bother. I don't know anyone who actually moves. It's kind of like Lifehacker, several other websites. Lifehacker is a particularly good set of instructions if you're a Windows user for either turning off the page file or migrating the page file to a regular rotating hard drive. Do you turn off the page file to save your SSD, or do you think this is a complete waste of time?
Okay, so let's go through some background here. First of all, the whole background on why you would bother migrating it to another drive in the first place. For those not running solid-state drives, right? Mm-hmm. And for those that had multiple drives in their system, that always made a lot of sense. Because you would try to launch an application when you were already on your threshold of what used to be very expensive RAM. And, you basically, your whatever little bit of RAM you had was full. And you're trying to launch some application off of your hard drive, off of your C drive. And then all of a sudden, Windows is like, oh, no, I'm full of RAM. What do I have to do? I have to take some of this and stick it on the drive and so that I could fit the thing I'm trying to load into the RAM. So it basically does this two-way shuffle with the data, right? There's stuff going from RAM to the disk, and it's trying to get other stuff from the disk into the RAM. Mechanical hard drives do not like doing that. That is this. You want to make a hard drive go slow, do that, right?
Right.
So the idea is take the page file, move it off to another spinning disk that you have so it can just sit there and do nothing but deal with that while your C drive is doing nothing but dealing with trying to load your application. Now, the reason hard drives suffer with that particular kind of a workload is the seek time. Solid state drives, seek time, not so much. It's not a big deal anymore. Right, the random access times you're talking about, split seconds. It's almost as fast as it takes just to read the next thing in a row for a solid-state drive. So random access like that, it's not really a negative aspect to a solid-state drive. However, RAM is dirt cheap, right. Like really cheap. My personal take on a system is if you don't have enough RAM where everything just fits in it anyway comfortably, buy more RAM. That's my own personal take. Because you see, what was it, like a 24, there was a deal for like 24 gig of RAM for like 100 and something, like low hundreds. It's like $120 for 24 gig of RAM. It's way cheap, right?
Right.
Now, if you're in a situation where you just don't have that much RAM, you are using a solid state drive, and you need to turn on your page file, fine, turn on your page file. But if you only have one solid state drive, which chances are, that's what you do. You have your C drive with your OS, and that's on the SSD. Put the page file on the SSD. You will notice the performance difference if you go try to put that thing on a spinning disk, even if it's one that's doing nothing but that purpose. Hard drives are way slower than, SSDs. You'll start to see the effect. Like your system will, when it starts to get on that threshold where it's using the page file, it'll start to slow down like before you installed that solid state drive level. You'll actually notice, right? It won't be as bad, but it'll get there. So put it on the SSD. Now, while it's on the SSD, yes, you are going to wear the flash faster because Windows in the background, as you're doing stuff, so you have some kind of video compression task running overnight, something is actually the CPU is doing work overnight. Windows likes to cache stuff in the page file. It tries to keep stuff, it does this even if it doesn't need to. The reason is that when it does run into a case where, I'm out of RAM, it doesn't want to have to deal with writing it all to it at that point, right? So it tries to keep like a sort of an update copy of what's going on in RAM, and it continuously updates that in Flash. So actually, over the past week, I've looked at some of this on my own system, and just my own system just running for a 24-hour window with the page file on will actually write between a quarter to a half of a gig to the page file total. So you're sucking up a quarter to a half a gig of writes to your solid state drive. That's not actually a lot. It is if you have a really small, like a 32 gig solid state drive, like a real baby size one. But if you have any kind of decent size one, it can handle that no problem. The bigger concern that I have with doing that is the page file does not get trimmed. And this might require a little more explanation here, but trim is the thing where Windows or a given operating system can tell a solid state drive, hey, I'm not using that stuff anymore. You don't have to keep track of what you were storing where. Well, if you have a huge file that's several gig large on the drive that's continuously getting 4K random writes done to it over time, which is what a page file update looks like. So you're basically taking a section of this drive and saying, I'm never going to let you know that I've let any of this go, that I don't need any of this anymore. And I'm just going to take this section, and over the course of weeks or months, I'm going to do torture to it. Because it takes it much longer to accomplish this, but this is exactly the kind of thing that I did to the original Intel X25M to break it. And that caused me to write that article, you know, many years ago. And that started a whole slew of people trying to scramble and fix solid state drive technology to make it not fail to that. One of those pushes was trim. So roll that back up, right? This is a file that will generally not be trimmed on your system. So depending on what controller you're using in your SSD, it may affect it in different ways over time. If you do this for a while and your system starts to slow down and it is an SSD that's trim enabled, do yourself a favor every once in a while, turn the page file off, reboot, turn it back on. That should delete the file and then it'll recreate the file. So, and that'll allow the solid state drive to like try to figure out what happened there. It's like, oh, okay, I don't need to keep track of that thing that he's been peppering with random small writes for the past month anymore. Good. And it'll clear that stuff up and then it'll go back again. But yeah, it's turn it off if you can. And if not, just, you know, put it on the SSD. Just realize it might slow you down a little bit over time. Me personally, I actually have it on because I've been I've been pegging my RAM in my main system. That's the only reason. Otherwise, it would be off.
Right. So rule number one, get more RAM.
Yes. Okay. The RAM is cheaper than another SSD, and you'll get better performance because you'll just have more RAM. You won't have to swap anything out. Yeah.
There you have it. We got an email from Bruce about x86 and ARM. And this is kind of funny. I've noticed a trend on these questions on Techzilla. Is there a possibility that ARM will replace x86 on the desktop? Is there any more that can be done with x86? Is there anyone trying to look forward to replace this aging architecture? Well, yeah, Intel. You know, there's been a lot of conversation. You know, we've talked a lot about how ARM is kind of the future, that ARM has the biggest volume in computing right now. These are all absolutely true facts. But no matter how cool the ARM processor is in your cell phone or your tablet right now, it is demonstrably lagging in performance compared to like a Core i3, a Core i5, a Core i7, especially one that is, you know, can be plugged into a wall for power like in a desktop. You know, will x86, you know, is x86 going to be like the last architecture or desktops going away? No. Will ARM catch up to the desktop in performance? Maybe. I don't have a clear enough crystal ball to see 10 years into the future. But believe me, you know, for people doing video editing, audio editing, massive research-based computational computing, dealing with huge amount of data crunching, dealing with all sorts of stuff, that there's an incredible list of computing efforts that basically everybody doing them wants bigger, better, faster processors. So I don't think that the desktop, especially the x86, is just a huge code base that runs on x86, is going away anytime in the near future. I think ARM is going to do its best. Oh, you know, actually, we should say now, as we were mentioning earlier, you know, the ARM, the Apple processors, the Tegra processors, Samsung's mobile processors, with the name I can't pronounce, they're going to try to catch up to x86 performance on the mobile and the desktop side while keeping it power-sipping enough to be in a handheld. And at the point when that happens, then I can see x86 finally going away. But I think Intel's going to make sure that the x86 architecture keeps leaping forward for a long, long time. And don't be confused. You know, it's the same for OS X and Windows. The code base running, well, more distinctly for Windows, the code base on Windows 8, where they're going to have a Windows 8 version for ARM, is radically different from the code base for the Intel-based, the x86-based chipsets. And that means, you know, different hardware, different development efforts, but mostly basically means the x86 stuff is not going to run on the ARM platform. So that's something to keep in mind as you're looking forward to, as you're prognosticating the death of x86. So,
yeah.
It's been getting a lot of questions around that lately.
So there's a hot part. Yeah, actually, there's a water cooling question from Tyler. Tyler's not in Texas. He's in, although there is a Tyler, Texas. Fun fact. Living in Phoenix, Tyler is. His problem is he has 5 computers in his house. His problem is not the noise, it's the heat, which sort of makes sense, right? He's in Phoenix. It gets pretty hot in the summer. Even in the winter, his office gets uncomfortably hot by midday and without dedicated cooling if I have all my computers running. Right, so that's just, I can see that, especially if he's in sort of a closed-in room kind of deal. While I realize it's a long shot, my holy grail of computer cooling is to pipe all the heat outside, eliminating the kilowatt space heater that my computer platform ends up equating to. He goes on, he's talking about punching holes in his outside wall, which he actually would consider doing. We actually have a guy, one of the PC Pro staff, Scott, showed us a picture the other day of, we don't have it here to show, but he's in Canada, and he had like a duct, like a dryer duct coming in from his window, and like on the front of like a, I don't know, like 10-year-old, like a 286 or a 386 or something. It was pretty funny. So yeah, that's doable, right? But where Tyler wants to go with this is more like, you know, because even if he does that, he's ducting in 110 degree air.
Right.
Where he wants to go is water cooling and have some sort of a loop to get the heat outside of his room and just somewhere outside the house. And then he talks about a radiator. And then even if it's hot outside, he can have like some sort of water drizzling outside the radiator and get a, you know, get evaporative cooling, sort of cool the radiator down a little bit. That's a lot of work, especially if he's got like five. I could see maybe doing that to one PC, right, like his big one or something. But if he has like five PCs in a room and he's trying to cool all of them, like, really, Tyler, you don't know what you're getting yourself into. Because if you want to cool the stuff, you need stuff like this, like big, expensive water black thingies on all of your things that make heat inside the computer, right? So, yeah, that adds up quick, right? So while the water trickle over the radiator outside thing, that will save you money. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, just getting the heat out of all those systems is, man. But he goes down a few, you know, possibilities of assuming he gets it all piped into something that's going outside. The thing I would suggest is instead of trying to do the radiator thing, if he has like a decent sized backyard and he can actually dig into his ground, if it's like soil, just get a, like a pipe, a metal pipe loop, and just run it. Like, you know, one loop would probably be good enough. You're just talking about PC hardware. You're only talking about like a kilowatt worth of heat. Even 2 kilowatts, it would be dissipated easily by like a 100-foot loop of piping that's in the ground. Not only that, but if you go, like, if you can go at any kind of depth in the ground, that's going to be much cooler than it is outside, depending.
I think it was funny because I love this question because, you know, I'm sitting there and thinking like, okay, so You pay the money for the CPU coolers, and you pay the money for the GPU coolers, and that's the vast majority of the heat coming out of your system. So PEX is amazing. PEX is kind of the, you know, it's kind of funny. You can't really use it in my TAM, but it's the new modern cool way of plumbing homes, and actually they use it a lot for radiant flooring too. So this is pretty stable, pretty bulletproof tubing. It's to be designed to be used in construction in your home to basically create all your hot water and cold water lines in your home. PEX is amazing. Yep. So you could probably run PEX outside. I'm not going to get into the speculation of what the local building codes are going to say about whether or not you're allowed to, you know, physically run lines. But you're exactly right. You're probably going to run it. You could normally, right, if you're in a insanely temperature part of the room, you could run all these into a car radiator, right? I've used that for water cooling. The problem is like Alan pointed out, you're in 110 degree weather. It's really hard to cool off your PC with 110 degree ambient temperatures, unless maybe your radiator for your PCs is in a swamp cooler, which is another pain in the ass.
I was just thinking that because Phoenix, I mean, a lot of people just have a swamp cooler.
So, you know, you put in the swamp cooler. And it's funny, like you were saying, overclockers.com is a great thread. And one of the only threads I've ever seen on external radiators for cooling stuff is to bury the line. It's basically you dig down the ambient temperature. Once you get deep enough in the ground, it's going to be like 52 or 62 degrees, even if it's stupid hot above the ground. And that would actually might be enough to cool it off, especially if you figure out some way to keep this area wet. But massive amounts of water, you're going to need a really serious pump. Like a normal overclock pump is not going to work for this. You're probably going to start searching around for something that'll do it, like the pumps they use for radiant heating in your floor. You've got to make sure the pump doesn't explode inside your house and cover the floor of your house with the 18 or 25 or 55 gallons of water it's going to take to actually run through 5 PCs out your wall and into the outside or down into your crawl space of your house. It might be simpler to put all the PCs in a closet and put an AC unit, which is something I've seen done something that used to be done by a number of people I knew in New Jersey, where they basically sacrificed one closet in the house and put all the PCs in that closet and put a basically cut a hole, basically permanently mounted an AC unit in that closet so that that would be cooled off. And those strange little rolled around AC units could be really useful for this.
You know, that might be an idea because, I mean, you could really extend, you can extend USB like 25 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you can have, you know, so just say you have your typical like Dell LCD that has the USB hub thing built in and stuff like that. So that's on your desk. You plug your keyboard and your mouse into that. You take the one cable out of that. You run it to 25 feet. And then if your PC outputs are HDMI or if you can get it to something like that, DVI or HDMI, I know Ryan picked up a few things for his office build out where it would convert HDMI to dual Ethernet, like physically. Right. Like it wasn't like electrically actually two Ethernet channels, but it was just a pair of Ethernet lines that you ran. So you can extend HDMI, like, you know, and that was rated for, I think it was something like 50 feet or 100 feet or something ridiculously long like that. So you can get it, the stuff to and from that far. As long as you get in the mindset of your PC isn't sitting right next to you, as long as you don't have that need, not really that much need anymore, considering most people aren't, you know, using DVDs for much anymore and most right. content is downloadable, right? So you probably get away with that, really. I think it's feasible.
It is feasible. It's kind of funny. There's a bunch of conversation in the chat room. It's like, what about using a mini freezer? And it's everybody like wants to use the little dorm refrigerators. The dorm refrigerators don't dissipate enough heat for five PCs. And the whole idea of running it into the freezer always sounds like a much better idea than it works out to in real life. It was interesting. Somebody actually suggested, and I apologize, I missed the name because it kind of whipped by on the chat page, but using a regular floor freezer like the one we've got in my house. And that might actually work if you can get the pipes into it without drilling through some important part of the freezer that actually contains Freon. So you can get through the wall of the freezer and you can, you know, be so if you have a, because basically what you need is a huge mass of cooling and a floor freezer, which you can pick up for like $250 at Costco. You get like a, you know, basically a 4 by 3 by 4 foot high freezer. And that actually
I don't know if I could keep up with a couple of kilowatts of heat load though.
Yeah, and that would be an expensive experiment. I know the ground can keep up with it. I'm pretty sure a swamp cooler can keep up with it. It might be an expensive experiment to put basically, you know, 40 feet of PEX or copper, you know, let's do PEX. PEX is going to be easier. And then you need to, you know, you still have all that line. You're going to fill all that, all those lines with antifreeze. And that would be critical, by the way, if you're going to be running it into a freezer. There's nothing more embarrassing than freezing your lines and killing an entire experiment. F Thinker all is like dry ice in the huge cooler. It's a great idea. And I also have to, except for the dry ice bills, I also want to ask Web 989 to repost what his so easy thing was, since that one also shot by. It's just so easy. And I'm like, what is so easy?
So easy. Web 989.
I
don't know.
Although iPad 741 has a really good one. Buy 1 6-pack of cold beer, drink beer, no longer care about PC.
Yeah. It's Scott's ducted cooling thing I was talking about. He actually linked it in the chat room. He's the Fopo Jojo guy. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty funny. It's just this old, you know, he's actually using like one of those old stereos with detachable speakers, like that's his sound setup. This is pretty cool. You know, it's like, I need amplified speakers. And that was before you can even really get, judging by the look of the computer, how old it is, and the fact that the monitor has a CRT in it. it was a while ago, right? So, yeah, just this ducting just going right to the front of the PC. It's awesome.
That's pretty funny. I will point out to Web9225 in the chat room, sticking in an aquarium filled with mineral oil, distilled water, not so good, because unless it's an absolutely unbelievable, and even if it is an absolutely unbelievably huge aquarium, the aquarium will slowly raise up to the sort of, you know, will rise to the temperature, to the maximum temperature sustainable by the ambient temperature in the room and the heat coming off of the water coolers. The systems, you know, doing the system in an oil bath, the first round of those, heat was actually an issue because mineral oil does not conduct heat very well, and it's really hard to pump mineral oil around inside a tank. You know, you can do it with water, but then you have, you know, you can do a huge tank full of water that was cooled in some way, or if you keep your house air conditioned all the time, it's a possibility. Always have, you know, more water always helps because it's easier to keep a large mass of water cooler than it is to keep a small mass of water cooler. But you still have to move all of that around and have something that draws the heat up. The heat's got to go somewhere. Physics tells us that. You just have to figure out where it's going to go. So I think we're going to wrap what is possibly the most newsed packed PC per the most news pack Twitch in the history of the podcast.
So what's coming up on Taxola?
No, I'm just like, I'm still waiting for Web 989. If you don't comprehend the science and forget it, because I really don't care. I'm like, the science of what? I still haven't seen the original.
I don't know. Did he say just stick it in the ground? Was he that one? I don't know.
Taxzilla, we're actually having a fun week next week. We're going to be talking about the iPad 3. Obviously, the announcement coming out on the 7th. We'll be waiting in the Apple store in case they actually release them for sale to tear one apart on Wednesday. We're doing follow-up questions. Windows 8 came out this week. That was really exciting. We did a full demo of Windows 8 on the show. And we've got a little mini roundup of Bluetooth speakers, which has been kind of fun. I've been shocked, actually. They're not going to replace like a $400 set of cans, but I've been kind of pleasantly surprised at how good a bunch of the Bluetooth speakers out there are sounding. So you got anything coming up on PC Per, Alan?
Actually, next time you're toying with Windows 8, you should toy around with storage spaces if you haven't already. It's a pretty cool thing. It's basically like it's a storage pool-based thing. You could basically make like a huge D drive. You just keep throwing hard drives at it. It doesn't care if it's serial ATA, SCSI, USB. You just keep adding stuff. And then you say, I want to make a partition using all that. And, oh, by the way, I want it to have like parity and like redundancy. And then when the storage space gets full, you just like tack on another drive and you just keep going. Or if a drive fails, it just dynamically like recovers as long as there's enough free space left amongst the rest of the pool. It's cool stuff. It's I'm toying around with it myself, but
are you doing FreeNAS or with
No, this is Windows 8. This is part of Windows 8. Yeah,
I haven't played around.
It's called
with
storage
that
spaces. Yeah, it's storage spaces is just part of it. You just like search for it. Yeah, it's just pretty cool. Pretty cool thing.
It's not based on ZFS, right?
No. It's actually in some ways better, and in some ways, like not feature match as right. that. But there's going to be a when the server version of Windows 8 comes out, it's going to have a variant of NTFS called REFS, which is extra resiliency and atomic writes and all this extra stuff that's even more of a close match to ZFS. Like it's file-based checksums and all this other stuff that they're throwing in there. So they're making it pretty serious. But the fact that you can get like the convenient part of that seriousness for the home edition or right. what you're going to be running and, you know, what could just be like your media PC. That would be awesome, right? Because
that'd be extremely awesome, especially since I have like access to two Windows Home servers that will no longer do the really cool thing about adding storage to a Windows Home server.
and the thing that makes me cringe is you see somebody has like this little home theater PC or something, and they have like five USB hard drives hanging off of the thing, and you just wait. You're just like, if any of those break, you're done. What are you doing? And so with this, you could have one of those unplug or break or whatever, and still gracefully recover. So that's pretty good.
I love parity data. It makes me happy.
It's good, yes. Very good. PC Per, what's coming up is, when AMD does come out with those, well, not the CPUs, but the GPUs. The GPUs are coming, too. Ryan's working on that one, and that will be out. I'm only allowed to say soon. How about that? I'm working on a Samsung piece, Samsung SSD. Wise piece. It's been a while since we looked at them. I decided this time to, instead of just looking at a given drive, which usually they just give us what they give us and we look at it. You know how you get some different drives and they have different capacities and the capacities have different specs, right? Mm-hmm. Like the smaller one, there's a point where you hit a smaller capacity where all of a sudden the IOs per second and the ratings drop to like a lower value. Usually it just has to do with how they've arranged the flash memory and how the controller talks to it. So for Samsung drives, I'm doing three different sizes of the same exact model. And I'm actually going to see what the differences are in reality versus what the claimed specs are. So pretty good. And actually, I'm not sure if this is up yet, but it's going to be up soon. If not, Tim, in one of our news guys, actually has been toying around with Windows 8 as well, except he wanted to do it in a virtual machine. So he's preparing a guide for VirtualBox and configuring Windows 8 under that, I guess, just to sort of help folks out. I will say personally, is I just happen to run it under VMware myself, it's almost painless because it has like a profile for Windows 8. It's like already in there. So you can basically just say, okay, here's your ISO, install and go. And it's just, it works. It's almost identical to a Windows 7 install as far as VMware goes. So it's pretty cool.
Very, very cool. Ladies and gentlemen.
And that's it.
That's it for this edition of Twitch. I'm Patrick Dorton.
I'm Alan Almontano.
We'll see you next week. Oops. Sorry, about to sneeze again.
We'll see you next. Achoo.
Pardon me.